the serious perturbation to the resonance of the element. So that's question number one. How did you flip from horizontal to vertical? What happened to the other feed line in the process? And second of all, was the second element still being driven, or was the second element truly parasitic? You used words that said both, so I'm confused. Over to you, Glenn.
Sorry about that, Dick. The other element is a parasitic element. The driven element has the switch box mounted on the boom, where it basically shorts once the non-used side and drives the open into the other side. So that's the driven element at, let's say, 3 o'clock for horizontal position polarization. And then when you want to go to vertical, it would short the 3 o'clock and then open the 9 o'clock. Does that make a little more sense for horizontal vertical polarization?
Yes, it does. Out of curiosity, was the shorting done on right where the feed line touches the antenna itself, the radiating element? Or was it done a quarter wavelength away, so to speak, or eighth wavelength away, whatever it was, on the end of the feed line that was closest to the boom? Where was the shorting and opening taking place, Glenn?
I'm not exactly familiar with his specific antenna, but the ones that I've seen did the switching on the boom itself, which was the suspension length between the where it was holding the insulator was holding the wire at the end to the boom. So whatever that insulator length was, maybe we'll just pass it back to the person that was asking the question. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, so this really is a two-element Yagi. And all of my experience, John, tells me that when you go from Yagi-like antenna, where each of the elements is a pure, flat-out, ordinary dipole, or you decide to make them into a diamond or a square, and we call it a cubical quad Yagi, or you make them into a loop, and we call it a loop Yagi, or you make them into triangles, and you call it a delta loop Yagi, believe it or not, the gain, everyone thinks that cubical quads have got a lot more gain than ordinary dipole-type Yagis. The experiments that have been done to date show that the increase in gain for cubical quad over ordinary dipole-like Yagi, the increase in gain is rather small. And is it worth fighting for all the extra mechanical rigmarole to mount the element that way is an interesting question. I'm not convinced it is. I know that on a large number of elements, like for instance a 10-element Yagi, if you go from a 10-element Yagi made out of dipoles to a 10-element Yagi made out of loops, you do not increase the gain. You have a slight difference in the frequency bandwidth. You have a significant difference in water vulnerability. Water droplets sitting on the tips of the elements of, say, for instance, a 1296 Yagi can detune the daylights out of it. In the case of a loop, the water droplets drop down to the center near the boom where they're inert and they're innocent and nothing bad happens. So weather-wise, a 1296 loop Yagi is a beautiful thing, whereas a 1296 dipole Yagi only works on a dry day. Let me drop. So, as I said, there are people who believe, because there's a lot more area of metal in the air with cubical quad antennas versus dipoles, they have come to the conclusion that it's going to have a lot more effective area. It does not. It's going to have a lot more gain. It does not. The gain increase, if it's there, it's small. So when it comes to building an antenna in the loop Yagi technique, quad loop Yagi antenna, it's a matter of what's your favorite construction technique. You're not doing it for performance reasons. Maybe bandwidth reasons, but not for performance reasons on any one particular frequency. Now, to build an 80-meter version of that, where each of the four sides of the loop is going to be 67 feet long, that's a pretty massive antenna, particularly if you're going to make it vertically, if the plane of the loops are going to be vertical. That's going to take you quite a bit of real estate. Well, if you've got tall enough trees nearby and you're willing to build this all up with wire and ropes and whatever, you can definitely do it. And since the ropes to the trees are going to be suspending the wires, that can be made to fly. I think your real question now is it going to have super gain as opposed to an ordinary dipole or a pair of dipoles? Now, maybe because of the particular arrangement of the trees in your in your yard on Eastwood Avenue in Deer Park, maybe you've got a right number of trees in the right location, that by ropes and wire, you can make these loops up in the air, so to speak, guide to the ground with insulated ropes, guide to the trees with insulated ropes, and the wire held in the right position with egg insulators. It could be a darn interesting antenna. It's going to take a pretty tall tree on 80 meters to make this all come out right as I see it, though, John. Maybe I've misunderstood you, but if you do decide to build it, I'd like to see it. WN2GYN, K2RIW.
KC2QIQ with a question after.
Okay. John first, and then Glenn. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, okay. It's November 2, Golf Yankee, Nancy, no W. And first of all, I'd just like to thank Glenn for interpreting or translating what I was trying to say. You did a very good job, Glenn, so I thank you for that. But the game dick is not really what its claim to fame or what I enjoyed or what I would like to achieve. It was the fact of being able to switch the polarization between vertical and horizontal easily as the band changed or as the person I was talking to it would change. In other words, somebody maybe, let's say for instance, close by, maybe in a 200, 300 mile range, might be better horizontal, but then again it matters how he's polarized. There's so many variables in that. The bottom line is the ability to just be able at your fingertips to switch between the polarization. That's the thing I'm intrigued about, not so much the game. Back to you, Dick.
I think you've got a good case there, John. Where you can switch polarization, you're always going to see an advantage on some days. One of the first serious antennas I built was six elements. Is it six elements? Yeah. Six elements on 6 meters on a common boom, six elements horizontal and six elements vertical. And I could flip between horizontal and vertical elements to feed, or I could feed them in combinations. And on 6 meters, there were times when I would see significant improvement of one over the other. So, polarization agility is what you're describing. That's a fun thing. Go for it. You're going to like it. It's not going to be night and day all the time, but there are days it's going to definitely give you an advantage. And will the advantage be on transmission or on reception? The answer is yes. Some days you're going to transmit better. Some days you're going to receive better. Some days you're going to do both better. And as you've been hearing, just because you're going to get the strongest signal from a guy when you're listening horizontal, it's quite possible he's going to get the strongest signal from you when you transmit vertical. It's just the way the ionosphere operates. It doesn't obey reciprocity. When the signal goes to the ionosphere from east to west, maybe the signal twists in a clockwise manner in polarization. You would assume when it goes from west back to east, it would twist counterclockwise the same amount. It doesn't. It twists a different amount and maybe a different direction. That's just the way a plasma works. Plasma meaning the ionosphere mixed with the Earth's magnetic field. That's what's causing the Faraday rotation. A combination of the magnetic field and a conducting plasma. Do you think you've got trees high enough that you can build all this on 80 meters? That's question number one. Is this going to be two elements in a two-element Yagi-like thing? Is question number two. And number three, do you have one of these now? And if so, what band is it on? Over to you, John.
I have a comment and to an enemy.
We're going to get to Alex in a minute. Go ahead there, John.
Yeah, okay. Dick, I think also Glenn wanted to add something. Well, I look at it this way. If I ran one leg over to Vanderbilt Parkway, maybe, you know, by your house, and the other leg over here on Eastwood, I might be able to get away with it. So We have to discuss that, I guess, off frequency. No, I just wonder if it's plausible, you know, and would it work as well on 80 as it did on 10? It worked great on 10. And you're absolutely right. I would sit there, and there were times where I received the person better vertically, but that person heard me better horizontally. So I actually would, I remember doing this. This is going back, oh man, some 35 years ago. I remember, you know, sitting there with my fingers on the box, and when I would transmit, I throw a switch one way. When I go into receive, I throw it the other. So, you know, you're very true what you're saying about how, you know, the plasma's in flux. So, I don't know who was supposed to get it. I think maybe over to Glenn, because he was first, I think. Glenn, N2GYN.
Oh, thanks. Dick, actually, my question for you is this. Let's say we have something that's the size of a 10-meter, loop mounted vertically like a diamond, and just one element all by itself. And we want to really shorten it, you know, keep it that same size, but operate that one element on, let's say, 80 meters. So we could put a ballon or something inside there and tune that one element to a narrow high Q element, let's say, for 80 meters. Following me so far?
Absolutely. It'll be extremely narrow band, but you can do that. And stand by now. As you go from full wavelength down to infinitesimal wavelength and keep retuning it, the pattern shifts. The pattern will shift in such a way that it has a null in the boresight, what you and I would call the boresight direction, in the plane of the loop. Correction, out of the plane. If I draw a line that is perpendicular to the plane of the loop, in that direction you will have a null. If you look at it edgewise, you'll be vertically polarized. You look at it flat on, you will be in the null as that loop approaches zero in wavelength. Back to you, Glenn.
Okay, very good. We're on the same page. Now, we take, let's say, like a regular Yagi linear element that's just running straight across the boom, in the horizontal plane. I can shorten that, and I can retune that in a similar fashion, right in the middle, with another ballon, and make another high Q, narrow frequency driven kind of element. With me so far?
Yes, and by the way, that infinitesimal loop that we described earlier, if you want to radiate from it in a rational manner, you'll change the orientation so that it's parallel to the ground. Now you'll be horizontally polarized and omnidirectional, and that is a popular antenna for FM broadcast. They put a stack of those small wavelength circumference loops. They put a stack of four of them up the side of the tower, and there's many an FM broadcast station that uses those as a horizontally polarized antenna. Now, okay, I think I see where you're going here now. You're about to make a horizontal dipole in the vicinity of this loop. You haven't told me what the orientation of the loop is going to be yet. Over to you, Glenn.
Well, no, the first thing I want to do is clear out of the air the idea of shortening out the loop as a diamond as a high Q narrow antenna. Now we're back to this Yagi structure again, you know, just a linear element horizontal on a boom. Now what I'd like to do is add some other elements, directors and reflectors. Is it possible to make shortened directors and reflectors, even if I just have a little narrow frequency in mind, and make like an 80 meter, but really shortened to something like a 10 meter size antenna, and be able to add some kind of directors and reflectors on it in a very shortened fashion? Back over to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
The good news is the answer is absolutely yes, but there's a catch. A Yagi is a number of tuned elements in a number of tuned positions. So a Yagi is a driven element and a bunch of parasitic elements. Each parasitic element is a certain reactance in three-dimensional space. You can create that reactance by making an ordinary director that is, let's say, 90% of a half wavelength long, or you can squeeze it down physically, but re-resonate it to the right frequency so that it presents the same amount of reactance at your operating frequency. You can definitely make a compact Yagi where each of the elements is a hell of a lot shorter. And as long as the boom is the same length, and as long as you've done the good job of retuning it, the super narrow band Yagi, narrow band in frequency, is going to give you 95% of the same performance. That's the good news. You start squeezing down the boom length, and now the reactances required to give you the Yagi structure, let me drop, the correct reactances start changing radically. It becomes a brand new design. In general, you will lose gain. If you go to Gunter Hack's formula, which he has spent a lifetime gathering, all the world's best Yagis, he has come to the conclusion that if you want to know the gain of a Yagi, you tell him how many wavelengths of boom you are using, and you assume that you put the right number of parasitic elements in the right locations with the right tuning of those parasitic elements on that boom. His conclusion is that when it comes to significant Yagis, and by that I mean more than three elements, boom length determines gain. It's an end-fiery antenna, and some dimension has to have the real physical length in order for it to have directivity, and it's boom length, assuming you're putting the right number of directors in there. Common sense would lead you to believe that if I chose a boom that is, I'm going to pick a number, two wavelengths long of boom, and assume I've got, I'm going to pick a number, 15 parasitic elements on that boom, and without changing that boom length, you would assume that if I go from 15 parasitic elements to 30 parasitic elements and properly tune them, that you're going to get more gain. The answer is no. Assuming that the original 15 elements were properly tuned, you can put as many elements more as you want on that same length of boom, you will not pick up more gain. I know this is a little off to one side, but it's giving you a little bit of the theory of how a Yagi works. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
You're forgetting about a very important characteristic of the loop, that knowing this might solve all the problems.
Can I ask another question there, Dick? Still along the same lines?
Yeah, let's go with Glenn's scenario first, then we're going to go over to Eric's Alex's scenario. You got it, Glenn.
Okay, great. I had to explain the other part first just to get you in the ballpark of what I was thinking of doing. It was just that this is a concept idea, but, you know, they make the devices that are rotatable Yagis. Rotatable dipoles for like 80 meters, 40 and 80 meters. And they're approximately like quarter wavelength hanging off of each side. What I was wondering is if you made a nice narrow banded antenna at about a quarter wavelength in length, let's say for 80 meters, talking roughly about like, you know, 62 feet. Now, how much gain do you think you could get with, with a limited number of elements on it that are relatively shortened to something like 10 meter wavelength, you know, in length, half wave at 10 meters, and stick it along a 62 foot length dipole? It would be kind of neat. Then you could have like more gain. Can you have more gain? Would you wind up with more gain than a rotatable dipole? If you follow what I'm saying, at full length for like a half-wave rotatable dipole. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, you've mixed two scenarios. Your words have created an ambiguity that have mixed two antennas together. A dipole that I squeeze down in physical size, I start off at full half-wave in length, and I keep squeezing it down until it becomes an infinitesimal dipole, but I keep resonating it. I lose less than half a dB of gain. I lose less than half a dB of effective capture area. And the gain that you lose is not an efficiency change. The efficiency, if you use the right materials, can stay near 100%. Just that the pattern becomes a little bit fatter as a dipole pattern when it has an infinitesimal length. So a dipole, physically shrunk, has essentially the exact same dipole gain and essentially the exact dipole pattern with only a half decibel of shift. Now, along that dipole, you're putting something else, and I didn't understand that. And if this is a multi-element Yagi-like structure, you didn't use the word boom, you didn't tell me the length of the boom, therefore I'm confused. Over to you, Glenn.
Okay, sorry about that, Dick. I was thinking that basically 62 feet at 80 meters or 75-80 meters is approximately a quarter wavelength. And if I were to build, let's say, a narrow band Yagi with narrow, you know, elements on there that were tuned along a quarter wavelength, not two wavelengths, but a quarter wavelength, would I have enough gain to be better than the dipole gain of a full wavelength, you know, full-sized rotatable dipole?
Okay. Even before I use the Yagi structure, I've got nothing but a driven element. And I move it to a smaller and smaller physical dipole, but keep resonating it. I've only lost half a dB of gain. Worst case, if I got lossless materials. So I've got full half-wave dipole gain on a nearly infinitesimal length dipole. Now, if I want to get more gain than that, I have to have multiple elements. When it comes to just two elements, there is a whole design philosophy where the second element, parasitically, or driven, but parasitically usually, can be very close to the first element. And if that second element, the parasitic element, is properly tuned, I can get a significant front-to-back ratio out of that. I got a lot of circulating currents, but I can get a significant front-to-back ratio. So you could say I'm going to pick a number, 2.5 dB of gain over dipole out of that. If I add a third element called director, and I want to do more of that with zero length of boom, so to speak, no way. With two elements, I can do it. The third element, when I add it, has got to be some real boom length, otherwise I'm not going to get any increase in performance. Maybe that helps a little bit. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, gotcha. That's what I was wondering. So in other words, you could still, though, even with two elements, do at least, even with a 62-foot boom, get at least, say, 3 dB over dipole in terms of gain. So you could actually get some improvement as opposed to just, especially if you just wanted to use one frequency as opposed to a rotating dipole assembly.
You said 3. I previously said 2.5. I'm now going to call it 2. You can get 2 dB of gain out of two very closely spaced elements, very carefully tuned, very narrow band, a lot of circulating currents. You better be using high-quality materials. You can get 2.5 dB of gain out of a two-element, 2.5 dB of gain, 2 to 2.5 dB of gain over a dipole out of two elements. But you start adding the third element, you're not going to get another 2 dB of gain, unless it's got some real boom length to it. You've already created the front-to-back ratio by having the second element almost being 180 degrees out of phase with the first element. You've created a null in the backward direction. You've got a peak in the forward direction. That's what the second element did for you. But when you start adding the third element, you're not going to get any increased directivity unless it's got some real boom length. You've got to start paying for the real estate, if you know what I mean. Glenn, go ahead.
Yeah, I gotcha. But so in other words, even a quarter wavelength that, in other words, the 62 feet wouldn't be enough. In other words, are you saying you have to be at least like two wavelengths worth of length?
Negative. My two wavelength of boom example was a 15-element Yagi. Maybe it was a 10-element Yagi. You know what I mean. Now that you're talking about two-element and three-element Yagis, that third element could be 0.15 wavelength away from the driven element, and it'll give you some performance improvement. Go ahead.
Okay, so in other words, that's within a quarter. You know, a quarter is 0.25. So in other words, theoretically, one could make an antenna in the 62-foot length with a narrow frequency, you know, shortened elements, and still wind up with some fairly decent gain above a rotatable standard full-size dipole.
I'm going to go along with that. It's going to be a very persnickety, critical design. It's going to be an awfully narrow band. But you've got modeling programs. You could model that antenna. And I'd love to find out, assuming you can trust the modeling program. Now, I've been hearing a few people tell me about modeling examples they've been giving lately, which have created results that I'm reasonably sure are beyond the laws of physics. So you've got to be careful with modeling. But EasyNet 3.0, I think, can handle this. And are you familiar with that modeling program, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yes, I am, Dick. I have a copy of it here. And it's okay. I mean, it's not bad, but I think there's a lot of initial parameters you have to be familiar with when you go to different types of antennas. And you really have to go in with it with a pretty good knowledge of the antenna first and have some reasonable expectations to what you're going to do and use the program at the end to really just to dot the I's, cross the T's, and maybe sometimes with small manipulations you can find the optimum, calculations. So it's good for kind of like dotting I's, crossing T's, and optimizing, but I think you have to have a very good understanding of the antenna first. That's why I like to ask a lot of questions to you about the antennas before I go back to the modeling program. K2RAW, KC2QIQ. Maybe you want to hand it over to Alex now.
And you seem to be saying that you got to start off with a pretty good seed antenna before you start doing an optimization procedure with EasyNeck. They can't just start off with any old Yagi. It might take you too long. Is that sort of what you're saying, Glenn?
Yeah, and I think you have to have a pretty good understanding of what the antenna, what to expect first, because there's a lot of variables you can plug into EasyNeck and come up with all kinds of bizarre answers. You know, I mean, but as long as you're keeping everything within the correct ranges of where they're supposed to be, you're going to wind up in the right direction.
Okay, now Alex, N2NNU, you were telling us that there's another whole class of antennas of Yagi-like structures where each individual parasitic element is a very small wavelength circumference loop. So I could build a loop Yagi where all the loops are very small and I'd have a brand new kind of performance. Give us a few words on that one, Alex. N2NNU, K2RAW. I know that Alex sometimes gets some local noise that makes it hard for him to hear this particular repeater. N2NNU, K2RAW, are you there, Alex? Okay, when he comes back, we'll pick up with him. And here, we did keep him waiting an awful long period of time. Mel, is there anything else you think we should be discussing? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Anybody else want to say something first? No. Okay. All right, well, I got a couple here. Here's one that's a bit interesting. I remember seeing this a few times. When I go to purchase coax cable, there's so many manufacturers making coax cable, and they all seem to have the same characteristics. And how do you really choose a coax cable such as the RG8 series? What is the pay and time to buy just strictly by price, or what do you do about purchasing ordinary RG8 cable? I know there's quite a number of course, ones on the market, and of course, if you go to different dealers, if they happen to be the authorized dealer for that particular cable, they always recommend it. But there's sure a heck of a lot of them to choose from, Dick, over.
Because RG8/U cable, RG-8/U, I think is the exact nomenclature, is controlled by a military specification. That's what those letters stand for. I think you'll find that there's very little difference between the brand names. The military specification controls the quality of that center conductor, the number of strands, the conductivity, the physical strength, the quality of the polyethylene dielectric, the quality of the braid on the outside, the quality of the outer plastic housing, and so on. So, as long as you're buying a respected brand that really is mil-spec rated, there's going to be very, very little difference. I know that there are a number of companies that make an RG8/U light cable. And if you look at the fine print, they may be calling it a like cable. But it's not really RG8U. It's RG8U like. The people, for instance, in Chile, can't think of the capital of Chile right now, but in Chile you could walk into a...
Go.
Say again?
Santiago.
Santiago. If I go into an electronic store in Santiago, and I buy RG8 you like cable, you'll discover that the outer braid has about 25% or 30% coverage. It's very, very thin number of strands, very poor coverage, a lot lower in physical strength. And my buddy who lives in Chile, who I've communicated with a whole lot, so have you, Mel. Why can't I think of what his call is now?
Great.
Say again?
Manfred XQ2FOD.
That's the guy, Manfred Morningwig. The quality of the coax cable he can buy is so low by our standards that on a number of occasions I have offered to buy him coax cable and mail it to him. And he told me that is not a solution. It'll take him a month of Sundays and a whole lot of bribes to get the cable I mailed to him through customs so that it gets into his hands. Maybe the only way I can get it to him is to go there and carry it as hand baggage. And assume the customs department doesn't think that I'm running a business or selling cable. So, in that case, yes, RG8/U like cable is going to be very different. When it comes to putting up coax cable on our antenna installations, if you're a VHF operator, in many cases you're going to want to consider using hardline cable. And you can get hardline cable very inexpensively from the cable TV stockyard. And it's got a lot more longevity, a lot more weather protection, can be directly buried, a lot lower in loss. And then you put a flexible link of cable, like RG8U, on the ends where it picks up the rotator. That's the nicest kind of an installation. The average guy who puts up a piece of coax cable wants to have one connector at the antenna and one connector at the transmitter and one straight piece of cable in between. All the same kind. Well, when you look at the problems you get with some kinds of flexible cable, you'd like some of that intermediate cable to be hardline if you're a VHF operator. If you're an HF operator, these fine points don't matter. That's some of my opinions on coax cable. Let's hear some of your opinions on coax cable, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Comment, and joining you.
Yeah, we wanted to hear from you also on that Yagi-like structure with very small loops. Over to you, Alex.
Oh, leave it. We can talk about that in person. I will not talk about it here. It was a mistake. Sorry for that. Anyhow, I was recently in the market to buy some cable. And as I am a picky engineer, I asked the dealership if he can provide manufacturing data, test data for the cable. And the answer that I got, well, it is all built against the standard. And I insisted, well, I know it is built against the standard, but does the manufacturer test the product if it is really so or not? And most, all of them said no, they don't test the cable. So now here you have a conundrum. Everybody says, hey, it's against the mill standard, but nobody tests what they make. So be very careful when you buy cable. And to an end.
Okay, I can sort of understand that once they've got control of the materials of manufacture, they've got a reasonable quality for the seven strands of copper or whatever, with or without silver plating for the semiconductor. They got reasonable control of the polyethylene that goes into the dielectric. They got reasonably good control of the machine that's laying down the outer braid, and so on. If you've got control of the materials and you've manufactured it for years and you're a known brand name, I can sort of see why you might not test every single roll. Maybe you do a spot check, you build 50 rolls and you test one of them. I can sort of understand that. But have you known, Alex, of an individual who bought good-looking cable of a almost respected brand name and ran into trouble? I have heard from time to time people who bought Saxon brand coax cable in the earlier days from Radio Shack, and they thought they were getting a pretty low-quality material. Apparently Saxon made some pretty yucky coax cable at one time. So do you know of any horror stories along these lines? If I was a naive engineer and I just went and bought some, am I liable to get in trouble? N2NNU, K2LIW.
Well, it depends how much cable you use. If If you need 100 feet of cable, 200 feet, 300 feet, yeah, well, you will be okay. You're going to get a really consistent product. However, when you have to spend several thousand feet or whatever, you better ask for a QA, quality assurance, because manufacturing cable is a foot-by-foot process. You can have a 1 foot good, or the next way it might be very bad. Most of the problems are in clinging to the braid and making little knots in it. Also, another problem is that core injectors are not, the nozzles of it do not work properly, and they stumble sometimes. If you really want to know your cable, you have to ask for quality assurance data. That's how I work. If you go to Radio Shack and get 100 feet, that's fine with me. And to any of
GC2 QAQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, just a quick comment for Alex. Alex, I've bought LMR 400 cable on the internet a lot of times because I find they're relatively inexpensive sources, and both the Ultraflex and the harder version that's not as flexible as the Ultraflex. But every time I get the cable back to the house, and I usually will put a couple of connectors on it just to check it really quick against the published what they can give you the losses are, per foot kind of a thing. And with a network analyzer here at the house, every time I put the cables on, they usually actually outperform the specification. But that's just been my experience.
Well, if I may have an answer to that, go ahead. Okay, Glenn, what you're doing, you're testing the cable in the frequency domain. You have to test that in time domain. You need a TDM, a time domain reflectometer, to test for consistency in the cable. Without it, you have just an approximation of what the cable is. The TDM will give you all kind of information that you never dreamed about. You take a run of 100 feet and you terminate it properly, inject a 100 second pulse on it, and then you see how your cable actually performs.
Yeah, that 1 nanosecond pulse going down the cable, if it runs into a spot with some knots in the outer braid, is going to give you a reflected signal like an echo from a radar, and you'll see some S11 at that time. In other words, if 50 feet down the cable you've got this knot, and if the cable had, in my example, a velocity factor of 100%, then 100 nanoseconds later you're going to see an echo on the input TDR, time domain reflectometer. Time domain reflectometers can be used in the reflection mode and the transmission mode. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, it's interesting because most of the time when I'm looking at it, I can usually measure, the phase delay and, check it against the length and most of those kinds of things, and I can measure the insertion loss of the cable length, and usually that looks okay. I guess my question next would be, okay, let's say there's a knot in the braid, like you're saying, and I don't see it in the insertion loss, and I don't see it in terms of, phase delay. What kind of performance reduction would I be expecting?
You're not going to see any performance degradation in the way you're using it. If you were using the cable to full capability, in other words, if that cable was rated from 0 to 2.5 gigahertz, and you were using it at 2.49 gigahertz, you may see a glitch in the performance. The TDR will tell you ahead of time. Now, you probably know that most high-quality vector network analyzers will have an auxiliary program you can plug in called the Steinhelfer program, which will sweep the cable at a whole lot of different frequencies and measure amplitude and phase of the S21, put it into this great big matrix, what is it, the word I'm looking for, a fancy program, a Fourier transform, and give you the equivalent of a time domain reflectometry measurement. So even with your vector network analyzer, there is a way that you could probably write a piece of software to do a TDR-like function. Over to you, Glenn.
What? Let's not forget that cables are used in different capabilities. If you happen to use this cable, example, in a phased array network, every little blemish on it will show up immediately.
Yeah, as extra side lobes and a change in the pattern. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, it's interesting. Unfortunately, the network analyzer that I'm using is a lot older. It's not that new. It only goes up to, you know, I think 2.5 gig. It's an HP unit, and it's not software or, you know, digital control. It's basically, you know, manual clanking on the front panel, and you look at the CRT, and you can, you know, do a small sweep of frequency range, but there's no way in there to... I know the analyzers you're talking about with the S-test parameter sets and the software-controlled analyzers, those are really pretty neat. But one of these days when I win the lottery, I'm going to pick up one of those, Dick. K2RW, KC2, QIQ.
Another comment about that?
Yeah, go ahead, Alex.
I don't have that call sign handy. But there is a German amateur that made a very fancy network analyzer with a very good graphical screen, and it gives a Schmidt chart and all kinds of crap, all for about 300 euros. Very, very nice instrument. I almost bought one myself when I had to spend the money on something else, but next time around I'm going to look for that document and I'll give you the call sign. It's one of the most prominent instruments coming out of Germany this time.
Now, Rode and Schwartz makes a very nice vector network analyzer, and Elric Rode, is he the guy you're trying to think about?
I really don't know, because call signs are not my... I'm trying to keep my memory cells as clean as possible. But let me find it here. I have a whole file here. I'll find it in the next couple of minutes.
Jake, with a quick comment on that one?
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I can most assure you it's not going to be Rode and Schwartz, because even at work we have a beautiful... spectrum analyzer from Rode and Schwartz, and if you knew the price tag on that, it's an eyebrow lifter. So it's got to be somebody else that makes something simple. I know most of the equipment that come out of Rode and Schwartz, it's really top notch and top price along with it.
Yeah, but Elric Rode of Rode and Schwartz, Rode and Schwartz, Schwartz, I think it's pronounced. He is a ham radio operator, and if you look up that name, you'll find that almost all the members of his family are ham radio operators. He's got two different European licenses and two different United States licenses. He does from time to time write articles of high performance, reproducible circuits that you and I could build, even though he's also simultaneously running this company, or he's heavily involved in this company that makes very expensive high-tech test equipment. And yeah, the vector network analyzer, the Rode and Schwartz that I use on a daily basis, which only goes to 8 gigs, but that's good enough for the work that I'm doing. My goodness, can that make measurements that you just can't get any other way. Very, very handy instrument when you're building the antennas that have to have extremely low S11 and guaranteed gain performance simultaneously. I set up that machine so that I get two simultaneous displays. My favorite way of doing it is a yellow trace is the S11 and the blue trace is the S21. So I'm looking at the gain and standing wave ratio simultaneously. And as I tune the multi-element antenna, I make one curve go up and I make the other curve go down. And when I get one curve to go down to the bottom, that's the S11, and the other curve get up to the maximum gain that number of elements is capable of giving, and I get that to happen simultaneously across the frequency range, and then we shout, "Eureka, we've arrived." Let's see if Alex has found that name or call letters. N2NNU, K2RIW.
Yes, I have it. His call sign is Delta Lima 1, Sugar November George. Delta Lima 1, Sugar November George. His name is Norbert Graubner. Graubner. And the article appeared in Funk Amateur. This is the radio amateur magazine, the prominent one, number 56 of 2007. So it's relatively recent design.
and I think that article is, I didn't take too much an in-depth analysis of it, but I think it is for HF purposes only. But I guess changing the DDS here to something that goes higher in frequency can bring it up to any speed you want it. Back to Dick.
Now, this is a inexpensive design for a vector network analyzer, if I understand you correctly. I am curious as to what he used for the sampling probes that do the phase measurement. Over to you, Alex.
Well, look into the schematic. The DDS is actually pushing into the load, and the sampling across a bridge of resistors into an IQ mixer. And the IQ mixer then comes out with the two signals, I and Q, and they are fed back to a peak. And it's all done in software.
Quick question. So he's measuring phase directly with I and Q. Very good. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, Alec, I don't know if I got the call wrong, but you gave me DL1SNJ. I put it into QRZ and it's not in there. I'm wondering, is that the right call or did I copy it wrong?
He said Sierra November Golf. Go ahead.
Thank you for the correction. KC2QIQ.
I wonder how many vector network analyzers are in the basement at your QTH, Mel. I don't have one in mine. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, not quite so far. I'll do what Glenn's suggestion. When I win the lotto, I surely will have one. I have a TDR. I have the AEA TDR, which I used to use when I was working. Boy, that was my right hand. Because there was constantly cables that were being damaged one way or another, something. So I worked on in a building, and they, some way or another, did a little damage to the cable and created a problem of the video on the monitor wasn't looking exactly the greatest. So I come along with my TDR after the guys were there that normally do the servicing, checking the camera, checking whatever they can. But when it came to where the problem is, get Mel. So take the TDR, be amazed. Told me where the damage is to the cable. Very simple handheld instrument, but works extremely well. Now, as far as cable goes, let me drop. When I was working, I had this question about quality and everything assurance. Because we bought an awful lot of cable, to say the least. God knows how many thousands of feet a week we run. And RG58U. And we ran it all over the goddamn place, you know, and up and down staircase conduits, twisted it, you name it. We just, you know, had a lot of different paths to take with the system that was, you know, building that, you just have to snake it around. So I asked them at Belden, and oh boy, I thought that sales guy, there, that engineer that I spoke to, I thought he's going to come through the phone and strangle me or something. You come out here and I will show you things, freeze it, cook it, this and that thing, how we assure the instrumentation, how everything is traceable and all. And so I'd be very doubtful if any of these top-line companies would take a chance and not producing a great product to go over.
Well, did they check, and did they have data for ultraviolet resilience? Because that is actually the killer of the cable, especially if it's hanging on the poles. I couldn't find a manufacturer that can give me data for that.
KC2QIQ.
Yeah, an awful lot of our coax cables, when they sit outside with ultraviolet exposure, turned in some very different product 2 years later. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I'm still having a little problem with this call on QRZ. Maybe I still have it wrong. I have DL1SNG.
He said the name is Norberg Graupner. Delta Lima 1, Sierra November George is what he said.
Yeah, that is correct.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not getting a hit on QRZ. But I'll try the name on Google, see what comes up.
And how do you spell Grosvenor? Go ahead, Alex.
Golf Radio Alpha United Bravo November Echo Radio Grosvenor. Yeah, Google it. Google it. That's the best thing. Germans are not very good in QRZ.
Now, Mel, I'm amazed that you said you use RG58, where an awful lot of the cable you were running is coupling video. I'm amazed you didn't use 70 or 90 ohm cable like RG59, RG6, because you were transmitting video, I think. Over to you, Mel.
Yeah, it was 59. I don't know why I said 58. I'm looking at here, RG8U, that's why, so I got the 8 in my mind. Now it's RG59, right, the 75 ohm cable that we used. The Belden, there was a Belden 8212, if I remember correctly. Yeah, Belden 8212 at the time, Dick. And I think if I remember that, it was a quality. Well, all I can say is we ran an awful lot of it. And other than damages that were done to it, you know, physical damages, I've never had any, you know, question about the deterioration from the elements. I have it here on the tower, this chunk that's on the, a couple of them on the tower here. I've been here now at least, well, I got the stuff before I retired, so let's see. I mean, officially, unofficially retired, 2005. I got it before that. I chiseled it out of the guy. It's going away present. And when I gave him a nice order, I said, I need some cable for my own ham use. He was kind enough to send me a nice roll of it. And so there it is. And so far, so good. Over.
Well, today business required 10 years usage of the cable in full sunlight. I couldn't find anybody today that can make anything like that into an any.
Yeah, I think many of them use an outer jacket that can't take ultraviolet for 10 solid years. That's a tough requirement. With the freezing and heating and ultraviolet and everything else that you've got with outdoor exposure, that's pretty rough on cables. With your time domain reflectometer, Mel, I bet there were quite a few cases where it told you the fault is 151 feet downrange, and you know that's where somebody pinched the cable going through a trough that's holding it or something like that. I am curious, Mel, what is the longest single length that you remember of RG59 that you installed in any one of your installations? Did you ever install, like, say, for instance, a 200-foot length of it? Over to you, Mel.
Sure. We used to have them going across telephone poles, across the street and everything. Some of the jobs, they had, like, parking lots. And, you know, the parking lot's quite large, and they had cameras out on poles out in the middle of the parking lot. So we put cables, went through, pulled them through. You should see some of these cables. We pulled them hundreds of feet through the conduits that were laid under the parking lot, things of that sort. Like I say, I never saw, you know, the years of working, some of the cables did go back a good number of years. They were exposed outside, and a lot of it would be like run across roofs on the edge of the roof, or just, you know, with a lot of, in fact, you know, if you could get away with it, you saw telephone lines strung around the roof with just the hooks driven into the wall. It was easy enough to mix in your coax cable and not have to make any kind of other changes, you know, like running some places. Oh, yeah, they insisted on conduits and all that stuff. That was specialized government installations. But like most places, they had any kind of, you know, telephone lines running with the hooks. Run the same trace. You ran the coax cable. Never saw a piece, you know, come apart or something that I'd say, uh-oh, you got a problem with this cable, and go up there and say it's just defective, you know. Anything we had was cut or smashed, mostly, I would say, I'm going to say 90% cut, take over.
So complete open, that was rather easy to see, not just smashed. You got to really smash a cable pretty hard before it makes a significant bump on a time domain reflectometer. It's kind of amazing how much you have to deflect it. A crazy question I've got for you guys. that I'm running my radio in my automobile from the cigarette lighter, which of course is not recommended. And I'm getting relatively poor performance because of that. I'm running a 1999 Toyota Camry LE four-door sedan. And every time I look in the engine compartment, I see no convenient way to getting a pair of 8-gauge flexible wires between the battery through that firewall into the passenger compartment. I see no convenient way to get through the firewall of that automobile. I'm tempted to try to just use the fuse box wiring directly, a fuse panel inside the passenger compartment. I don't know if that wiring is heavy enough to do it. I'm having trouble believing that that's going to be heavier wiring that goes to the cigarette lighter. The cigarette lighter wiring is obviously nowhere near heavy enough, because when I put my 30-watt transmitter into the transmit mode, the front panel goes dim. I can tell the voltage is dropping tremendously, and I think it's occurring right at the cigarette lighter itself. So anyone has any suggestions as to the easy way I can, in a weatherproof manner, get a good heavy lead between the passenger compartment and the battery, I'd like to know about it. KQRIW.
Don't you have a fuse box next to your left foot?
KC2, QIQ.
Yes, I do. And I guess I'd have to assume that that fuse box has a heavy enough lead from the battery. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. And in other words, you're telling me there's a heavy lead from the battery to the fuse paddle right by my left foot, and then there's only a light gauge wire from there to the cigarette lighter? Maybe they wired it that way. I'm kind of curious as to why they would do that, because one of the heaviest drain objects I know of is a cigarette lighter device. Over to you, Glenn.
A lot of these little compact cars, and usually my favorite place to sneak it through is a lot of times either, usually by the brake pedal, there's a rubber boot, and if you look very, very carefully underneath the dash and you peel the carpet back just a little bit, you'll see that there's a very thin rod that'll go usually in a 2-inch diameter hole with a big rubber boot around the outside. A lot of times what you can do is take a nice, very, very thin hole punch and put a small punched hole on the bottom, not on the top, but if you can get to the bottom of the boot and just pierce a little hole in there, and you can actually run them through the rubber grommet and then bring it into the firewall from there. And as far as the wiring goes, it's not so much the fuse box itself that's the hassle. It's that the wiring usually goes from the battery to the alternator, from the alternator back down, you know, through another harness over the top of the engine that's really hot, and a whole bunch of other nasty things. So getting the separate wiring is a much better deal.
I'll tell you what Joe's got to say. Thank you, Glenn. Joe, how do you solve the problem? How did the Robin Timmy solve this problem?
Well, Bean, I used to install radios in cars many, many years ago in another life. I always ran stuff right to the battery, one way or the other. Most of these vehicles, if you look very carefully, the wiring from the inside of your car has to get to the engine compartment. Usually in that group of wiring, it goes through a plastic or some sort of rubberized type of bulkhead connector. You can usually find space in there to put a wire through to get some sort of, you know, like 8-gauge wire through there, or to the side of it slightly. If that fails, you can't do that at all. Another possibility is to look at your transmission tunnel, if the thing has the motor in the front of the car, which I think that car probably does, or some sort of lower part of the fork near the center. You should be able to get a wire through from there through the engine compartment up to the battery. Take a look at that very carefully. Make sure you're not drilling with your catalytic converter, of course.
So you like the tunnel near the center of the car, or I think you're saying that this through the firewall plastic connector, is that usually located very close to the fuse panel? Go ahead.
Yeah, reasonably so. Let me turn this radio to the center. I'll get feedback here. It's getting a little annoying. There we go. The wiring inside your car is really, if you look at it from an electrical standpoint, it's sort of halfway between your alternator and your battery. You're always going to get some sort of ripple noise across those, any of those wiring. And even if it's a high, heavy gauge wire, it can carry a lot of current, it's still halfway between your battery and your alternator. So it's never really a good choice to put it there if you could possibly do it. Best to go right to the battery, put a 30 amp fuse on like another 8 gauge wire, and there you go. You got a nice direct source to the battery. If you want to have it controlled by the ignition, put a nice heavy relay in the series that line control it with the ignition source or ignition accessory. Now you got to on off your radio when you get out of the car. How's that sound?
K2YO.
YO recognized, but Joe, back again now. You make it sound like you only run one lead to the positive terminal of the battery and you